Words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the fourth in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Mark, I'd like to speak to you today as an opening on the Sabbath, the Jewish Sabbath, as the first great democratic religious phenomenon that we know of in human experience.
That's a very interesting use of the word democratic. Quite possibly, Maurice, never before in the history of the world have the Sabbath and democracy been somehow or other yoked.
Well, I think of it as the most astonishingly egalitarian expression of human relations.
I suddenly see that it is.
The Sabbath was given to man in order that on a given day, about which we shall speak, on a given day he divests himself of all the harassments, which is to say also the limitations, the difficulties, the problems of his daily life, and suddenly he is restored to the primal condition of the human being under God. And notice, it is under God, because this has to do with what we were discussing, the equality and the dignity and the sanctity of the individual, restored to the primal condition of man, as though all the evil of the world didn't exist,
And all the inequalities of the world.
All gone. This is the Sabbath, which, it's curious, the ancient world didn't understand. The Sabbath was known in some vague way, Roman writers or Roman personalities. Nowhere is there a glimpse of understanding as to what the Sabbath means. It was derided by them. Juvenal made fun of it. There is a passage, I think it is in Suetonius, in which the Emperor Augustus makes fun of it, or rather misunderstands it completely, although strangely enough among the Roman masses, it caught on. There was something of a glimpse of liberation in it. And this Sabbath has, in my opinion, not been understood very widely in its meaning, and I am afraid in its meaning is fading even from the Jewish consciousness.
Well, I suppose in many people's mind, the Sabbath has now become merely a day when they don't work.
Yes.
A day of rest.
And therefore the less significant, because so much less work is being. We have 2 days of rest practically now in America. Soon, I suppose, we're going to have 3 days, perhaps
three or four.
More.
Well, however, it has its importance even then. I would say that even now, when the original significance of it has faded out in many minds, even now, the Sabbath, as a day on which one does not work, one does not go anywhere particularly, one does not do anything particularly, has become some kind of very special day. You feel differently on that day. You may be bored, incidentally, because you have nothing to do. Some people are, until they get in their cars and they go out and they fill the highways. Nevertheless, they're free to do that. Instead of going to an office, instead of teaching or whatever they do, they are moving freely about. Now, of course, the Sabbath that you have in mind, the ancient Sabbath, the ancient Hebrew Sabbath, was not a day upon which you went and diverted yourself. There was no place where you went to do that. You remained at home, didn't you?
Well, there was something more than that, than simply remaining at home, as
yes,
you say.
Yes, I know more than
something
that.
Something more than merely resting. It was a day on which you were re-sanctified, into which you recovered your image of God, if you like. It was something, by the way, that was very powerful during the Middle Ages, is still very powerful among some Jews, and the vastness of its meaning, I can't use another word, the vastness of its meaning is indicated in a prayer, the sanctification of the Kiddush, which ushers in the Sabbath on a Friday evening, when the Sabbath is celebrated on two grounds. One, of course, that we all know, that God wrought for 6 days, and produced the world or the universe. And on the seventh he rested. I prefer to translate that passage, on the seventh he made a Sabbath. Yeah. Not that he rested. And that is one ground. The other ground that's given in that introductory prayer of the Sabbath is that that was when, this is to celebrate the coming forth of the Jews from Egypt and from slavery, and that is to receiving the law at Sinai. In other words, the Sabbath is seen as celebrating the ordering of the universe out of chaos, the physical universe, and then the bringing of order into human relations out of human chaos.
Yes, well, I was merely trying to say that even at the faintest, and even at the palest, Maurice, the Sabbath retains, if nothing else, a kind of charm for people. It is a day on which, by very virtue of the fact that you're not working and that you're not subject to a routine which has put your mind somehow or other to sleep, you are free, at any rate, on this day to relax, as we say, to be more yourself than usual, to just let things happen. No, that's, as I say, the very faintest,
yes,
palest copy of the original thing. Well, now, there's this. I've often asked myself this question. What would it be like to live in a society which had nothing like this at all? There must be societies, aren't there?
The Roman society had its festivals. There was a festival like the Saturnalia. There would be certain nefast days, as you remember, when it wasn't propitious to begin a certain piece of work. There were days dedicated to certain gods. But a regularly recurrent rest period during which you were rededicated, that this is the period when you stop worrying about a living. You stop worrying about your problems. All your human complications are smoothed out for you. You ignore them. You are forbidden on that day to mourn for the dead. The recurrence of such a day is not to be found, as far as I know, anywhere else. And you must remember, you've just said that this wasn't merely the day on which you didn't work and which you became, as it were, carefree and careless. We are told, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy.
Yes, I was going to remind you of that. Holy.
It says,
remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Yes.
You live in sanctity on that day, mm-hmm, whoever you are. And it applies to the servant as well as to the master.
And to the animals.
The animals must rest also. The very sight of work should not be thrust upon your attention. The whole of this laborious existence of humankind to which we are condemned by the nature of things must give way to a vision of what the perfect world would be like, where we would do nothing except delight in, they call holiness, we would call it in spiritual values.
You know, I've always remembered from reading your World of Sholem Aleichem, I've always remembered your very wonderful chapter on the Sabbath, on the privilege that was, on the way the Jews of the shtetl, in the village of Europe, looked forward to the Sabbath for days before it came and then looked back at it for days after it had gone. The Sabbath was the crown of the week, wasn't it, for them?
Yes, I would say they lived in the shelter of the Sabbath. For 3 days after the Sabbath, they were warmed by its recollection, and for 3 days before it, they were warmed by its anticipation, and somehow they managed to get through the 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it was that they had on the Sabbath, the remarkable thing is, such a spirit did, by and large, descend on the shtetl. One asks oneself, what was the psychological technique by means of which they were capable? It's almost like a post-hypnotic suggestion. On that day, you're going to forget your worries.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. Now, nowadays, of course, we have books instead. But there was somehow a system had been inaugurated by which the national memory, or the folk memory, worked, and on the seventh day there was this rejuvenation. It says, "Ye shall do no manner of servile work," we are told. Work of a kind there was, namely learning was permitted. Learning is work.
Well, learning is also happiness.
Learning is happiness. Learning is not servile work.
So it was proper to study then.
Proper, commendable, and advised, and indeed, if you didn't do any studying on the Sabbath, you are not having the good time in the highest sense that you're supposed to have.
Now, to what extent was the Sabbath in those days a day of ritual? To what extent did the time pass in prayer?
Well, if you're referring to the shtetl, that I don't know it firsthand. I know it through my family's memories of it. It was a very wonderful day. There was a lot of ritual, but it was taken with joy. You went in your best clothes to synagogue in the morning. You came home at noon, and well, let me begin with the evening before.
Yes,
you were supposed on Friday afternoon to be in the anticipatory thrill of the Sabbath, and the Friday afternoon prayer you were supposed to. Not you were supposed to, it was obligatory to recite the Song of Songs with all of its delightful memories. That was the day on which you took a bath, even if you hadn't had the opportunity during it, then you had to on that day. Mm-hmm. And you must remember that in the Middle Ages and in the shtetl, a bath wasn't the simple thing that it is now. Then you went to synagogue and you came home to a house that was lighted by candles. Tablecloth was spread over the table, and the best that you have has to be laid out on the table. Then there was the sanctification, there was the kiddush, rather, the blessing. And afterwards, you sat after the, you had said the, eaten the meal, and said the grace after meals, you generally sang around, and you sang zmirot, they call them, melodies. Saturday was full of prayer. In the morning, noon, you came home. There were three meals obligatory on the Sabbath. There was the Friday night meal, the noon meal, and the afternoon meal on the Sabbath. And in the afternoon, you were obliged to take a nap. You were obliged to. This was a choreographic nap.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you could lie down for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, anyway, you had fulfilled your duty. Mm-hmm. Then you woke up refreshed. You sang songs. You studied the law. You were supposed to read on that afternoon one of the most beautiful books in the Jewish literature, The Ethics of the Fathers. You're supposed to go through the week's portion of the law, twice in Hebrew and once in Aramaic. It was a busy day, all right.
Yes, now tell me about the songs you say they sang. What did you, was Zmirot?
Zmir, it's simply the Hebrew word, Mark, meaning Zemer, song. Zmirot is simply songs. They were hymns.
Yes, but what were they?
They would be songs about the, well, one of them, I would simply have to translate.
Were they old?
Old songs, oh yes. They were old songs. The Ribbon, Dalmaya, having to do with the Lordship of God, the coming of Elijah. And then there would be, all of them were curiously in a minor key. They were not a boisterous happiness.
Mm-hmm.
This was not an earthy, shall I say, peasant happiness. It was a reflective, meditative happiness shot through with the recollection, all that was forbidden, but surely at the back of the mind, there was the recollection of the misery of the weak, the hostile world, the indignities which the Jew had to suffer outside of the shtetl or sometimes in the shtetl. All of this shut out, nevertheless, by its suggestion, lifting the level of the actual enjoyment until in the evening you had a valedictory poem which you said farewell to the queen. The Sabbath was apotheosized into a queen whom you had welcomed the night before in a very famous song. You'd welcomed her the night before on Friday, and now you said farewell to her again with sad, haunting, and very tender melodies.
Yes, I remember that Heine as a poem about the Sabbath queen.
Yes, the princess in Sabbath.
Yes.
The princess Sabbath, and in which, curious that this man who was, wasn't at all Jewish, as a matter of fact, he was converted in his boyhood, or in his early manhood, had a very deep, passionate insight into these things, wrote many things on Jewish law.
Oh, he did.
And his vision of the princess Sabbath has been translated into Yiddish by the great poet Bialik, and sounds much more like what it ought to sound like than it does in the German. Somehow the German doesn't fit. Oh, it's the best the language can do with a subject
well,
like that.
Well, Heine, I happen to like very much, and he fascinates me always, because in him there's the well-known mockery. He's a very mocking man. And yet, that can be the tenderest, most penetrating seriousness.
You remember that, to digress a moment, you remember that characterization of him by Matthew Arnold. He said, "The spirit of the universe let a smile of mockery pass across its lips."
That's right.
That smile was Heine.
That's right.
Well, he had that mockery, and at the same time, he was sentimental, deeply sentimental. And in Jewish things, he had the some of the longings of the exiled person, exiled himself from Jewishness and always longed for it. And his understanding of the Sabbath was very deep and very tender.
Well, if I may say so, I would say this, that in many Jews, there's a spirit of, maybe mockery is not the word, there's the spirit of play, their minds play. They love to let their minds play. Maybe not to the ultimate effect of mockery, but something like that. Do you agree?
Yes, I do. I would agree with that remark, and I would put it this way.
I cannot dissociate this from...
They had to learn...
Meaning, from what Jewish means
they had to learn for a long time not to take the world too seriously, otherwise they would have gone under.
Yes.
They couldn't face it with a smile, and sometimes with a touch of derision, they would have broken themselves. But in this return to oneself on the Sabbath, they anticipated the future of mankind. The world to be in the Messianic age was to be one long Sabbath. And the most holy day of the year, the Day of Atonement, was called for them the Sabbath of Sabbaths, the Shabbat, Shabbaton. They saw it as, I said before, co-evil in importance, or equal in importance with the creation of the world. And the Sabbath had been created, as a matter of fact, millions of years before the world. It was there waiting to find its application in a human species.
It was an ideal thing. So that you don't derive the institution of the Sabbath entirely from the statement that on the seventh day God rested. That isn't the only source or background.
If that had been the only source, we wouldn't have had the idea of the pre-existence of the Sabbath, just as we have the pre-existence of wisdom indicated in the book of Proverbs. I would say, Mark, that the idea behind the Sabbath was a little glimpse of the perfectibility of man. Mm. That man's enslavement to nature or to the human condition. Or further, we would have to face a problem of a world in which there is no labor. Now, in the commentaries, in the various rabbinical plays of the mind around the Bible, we're told that Sabbath sanctifies also the 6 days of labor and makes that labor something more than mere submission to the necessities of the flesh. And I come back to the question, what happens in a world where there is no labor? We're being...
We're being asked to think about that.
Yes, we're being threatened with a world, Mark, in which there is no work.
Yes.
What happens with a Sabbath, then?
Well, you know, some people are telling us that we should learn how to be leisurely, learn how to develop the leisure, to capitalize the leisure we shall have. Through most of human history, most of us have had no leisure at all. It has grown until in our time everybody has at least 2 days, as you say, a week of leisure, and maybe several weeks in the summer or in some part of the year, which we call a vacation. But what when automation is complete, and it could be more complete now than it is? Except that
We're at the very infancy of automation.
Yes, I know, but also we're afraid of it, too. We don't know what the consequences would be. But say it became complete, and these monstrous machines ran everything, so that almost none of us had anything to do except maybe go down on Thursday afternoon at 2:30 and press a button.
Yes, it's collect salary.
Well, if we despair when we think of that, if we are panicked when we think of that, then I suspect we are lost. We ought to be happy, hadn't we?
Well, here is the odd situation, that we have not been trained to regard leisure as anything other than a cessation from work.
Cessation from work.
And this idea of the sanctification of one day is to remind us that we are not here simply for the purpose of satisfying ourselves by production and consumption of goods. One of the things that bothers me, frankly, about the continuous race to produce and produce more, what have they got in view at the end? I mean, a society which isn't producing more by 5-6%, we are dissatisfied with our own 3% gross national product. But where's the end? I mean, after all, what do they think they'll reach, say, at the end of 50, 60 years, when they'll have, we've got a 5 billion, what is it now, 300 billion, 500 billion? Suppose when we've got a trillion or 10 trillion or 50 trillion gross national product, where do we go?
Yes.
What do we do with it? And the degradation of the concept of leisure is implicit in the view that we ought to consume in order to be able to produce, and if we don't consume, there'd be no producing. You remember the thesis, by the way, in this brave world of Aldous Huxley, was this world where, as a matter of fact, everything had reached a balance of production and consumption, and the poor creatures that were no longer human beings who subsisted under that system were not humans at all.
Yes. Well, of course, it's also been considered recently that rather than become obsessed with production and productivity, we should begin to consider what goods might be turned out for the good of all. You see, now we keep on producing things and forcing the things upon people who don't want them very much. Maybe I shouldn't say this over the particular medium we're now using.
Well,
such mediums have been used to convince people that they want something they don't really want.
Well, this medium has have to change its mind, or this medium will also disappear. Because if it doesn't teach people to appreciate simply the exchange of words and the development of ideas, it too will have no future.
You know, I'm interested. You were saying the other day that someone had once said that more than the Jews have kept the Sabbath has kept the Jews.
Yes, that was the Achad Ha'am.
Yes.
It's a very deep saying that, at any rate, there is a reciprocal action. It is easily arguable that if the Jews had not had, on every seventh day, this respite, this reassertion of their value in God, this reminder that the world was not their master ultimately, that they had to accommodate themselves to it, but they're not to prostrate themselves before it, they would have gone under.
Right.
And if they hadn't, it's curious of me to call it a trick, a device, some kind, almost a kind of a dodge. How on that day they retreated from the world. And it wasn't just the question of denying the existence of the world. There was a time, you've certainly read about it, when, for instance, Jewish zealots, or not, they weren't the zealots, historically speaking, the Hasidians or the Hasidim, wouldn't fight on the Sabbath. They allowed themselves to be killed on the Sabbath. And they overcame that, naturally, because the law says, Mark, that the Jewish law says that the Sabbath has been delivered into our hands. There is a distinct midrash that says, the Sabbath hath been delivered into your hands, and not you into the hands of the Sabbath.
Hmm.
And although work is forbidden, you are told that when life is in danger or some serious calamity threatens, you must break the Sabbath. For instance, although you may not do any work, you'll find specifically stated by Maimonides that you may smash down doors with axes on the Sabbath if a child behind that door is frightened.
Mm-hmm.
Released that child, rather than let the child be frightened, you may smash down the door. Let alone then, if somebody is sick,
yes, but
or to minister to the sick.
But wasn't it preferred that the person who did that, who broke down that door, was a person who was somehow properly qualified to do so?
That, you mean a particularly pious Jew?
Yes.
Yes, Mark. Now, that is the amusing, the charming thing about it, namely that they would have preferred a rabbi to do that in order to show that the Sabbath was made to prolong the life of man and to that he might live thereby. They might live by the law, rather than it was a day of restriction and of privation.
Yes.
All of the details which grew up around the law had been intended, even if they were not understood later, had been intended as adding color and beauty to the day.
Well, it is to me a very beautiful and colorful conception altogether, this conception of the Sabbath, on which everybody, I dare say, among other things, remembered, as it might have been difficult for him to remember during the week, his importance in the world. I mean, that importance which attached to him because he had been created and because he was he had the sanctity of his individuality. Many of the injustices practiced upon him during the week were no longer possible now, and he shouldn't even remember them, I dare say, so that on this day he could say, as the psalmist said, "Thy condescension hath made me great."
Yes, escape from a double bondage. Remember, he was in bondage, as all human beings are, to the necessity of a livelihood, in his case a particularly difficult livelihood, and he was in bondage to a surrounding people which was hostile to him. And all of a sudden, he dismissed both of these and said to them, "You don't exist.
Yeah.
I am here by virtue of being a Jew and by virtue of observing the law which God promulgated through Moses. I am beyond your reach." And he was.
Yes, and that not merely by virtue of remaining in his house or remaining in his village. It didn't have to be a physical wall about him, or protective casing, did it?
No.
The idea itself surrounded him.
Yes, his imagination could range through all the world and through all the worlds that had ever been created before him. He was, on that day, king, and his wife was... Again, we are using these anthropomorphic terms. You remember last week I commented on calling God king. He was anthropomorphic. We are confined to these terms. He was a king and his wife was a queen, and the children were princes and princesses. No matter what the condition of the house, no matter how poorly they had been compelled to celebrate the Sabbath, he had been exalted, or rather restored, not exalted, exalted to the rank and the condition which God had intended for him and for all other human beings.
Maurice, this is wonderful, and I'd like next week not to let you off from telling me something about the year of Jubilee, which was 7 times 7. Isn't that true?
Yes.
Just heard "The Words We Live By," the fourth in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of democracy and the Bible. "The Words We Live By" is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.